the Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Don Crane, and he'll be answering your most important questions on floating Alaska, self-guided fishing expeditions. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Don a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Don Crane about floating Alaska, self-guided fishing expeditions. Is it a kayak or a rowboat? The new OSG Commander from Outcast Sporting Gear is the best of both worlds. The OSG Commander is a 35-pound inflatable fishing boat with kayak maneuverability, simple oars, and an open cockpit for easy wading. With the OSG Commander, you can fin kick slowly along a steep shoreline, stand up and fish a shallow gravel bar, and row down to your favorite fishing hole. Find out more about the OSG Commander at www.outcastboats.com. That's www.outcastboats.com. Outcast, leave the crowds behind. Before we introduce Don, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For a drawing tonight, we'll be giving a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing tonight. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing yet, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Don's section that says, click here to register for the drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Don's book, Floating Alaska, courtesy of Frank Amato Publications. And to find out more about what Frank Amato has to offer in the way of books, go to www.amatobooks.com, www.amatobooks.com. So here's how you can win Don's book. You got to be the first person to answer the question that we ask at the end of the show. And the question's going to be about something we talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So just fill in those blanks, send it in, use your best typing skills, and if you're the first one to give the correct answer, then you'll win Don's book. Tonight, our guest is Don Crane. Don grew up in Colorado in a family that loved to hunt, fish, and camp. His career as a district wildlife manager with the Colorado Division of Wildlife began in 1968. He was first stationed in the St. Louis Valley of Colorado and then transferred to Rifle, Colorado. He retired from the division in 2000 and moved to Cody, Wyoming that same year. Don worked and guided fly fishers for a Cody fly shop in 2002 and 2003. And in September of 2003, he started selling African safaris, worldwide fishing, and wing shooting vacations for safari outfitters in Cody, and is still doing that today. In addition to Alaska rivers, some of his favorites that he's fished in the U.S. are the Gunnison, Roaring Fork, Frying Pan, Colorado, Arkansas, White, Green, North Platte, Shoshone, Missouri, Clark's Fork of the Yellowstone, Wynn, Madison, Jefferson, Firehole, Lamar, Big Hole, and Bighorn, quite a few. And internationally, Don's fished several rivers in Canada, including the Bow, Elk, Crow's Nest, and Bellacoola. Don spent a month fly fishing many of New Zealand's rivers, which was a highlight of his fly fishing experience, as was fishing some of Costa Rica's jungle rivers. In 2004, Don wrote Floating Alaska Self-Guided Fishing Expeditions, which was published by Frank Amato Publications. Don has been involved with fishing and hunting for as long as he can remember and has been a fly fisher for approximately 45 years. Don continues to give back by teaching wildlife conservation and fly fishing, which also has given him great satisfaction. Don, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Well, great to have you. And we got lots of questions, and we're hitting a subject that's always fond for me, which is getting in a boat or a raft and being on the river. One of my favorite things to do. So I'm looking forward to talking about it with you tonight. And what we've got here is Don's done some self-guided expeditions up in Alaska, and he's written a book on that. And, of course, it's one thing to float a river around the corner from your house, but it's another thing to go partway around the world to do it and do it successfully. So hopefully we'll learn a lot from Don tonight about the do's, don'ts of doing these self-guided expeditions. So what came up first as questions by a couple of people, including Scott Heat up in the Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Scott's involved with the fighting against the proposed pebble mine up in the Bristol Bay region, which is, I think, a lot of the rivers that we'll talk about might be. But he asked, what rivers have you fished in Southwest Alaska? What are your favorites? Along with that, what rivers do you recommend? What rivers would you avoid? Are there some that are overfished? Those kinds of questions. So what rivers are out there that we'd definitely like to look at, Don?
The first river, Roger, that my friends and I ever floated was the Kinnectock. Just a fabulous river in Bristol Bay. It's a good one for your first trip, although there are a lot of sweepers, and the upper end has a lot of trees, and so you got to be careful. If you go through at low water, then you might have to drag the raft a little bit, but it's a very special river. It's close enough to the ocean where the salmon are good fighters. In other words, they're like the silver salmon, which is what we prefer. We call them chromes, and chromes fight quite a bit better than the salmon that have been in the river for several days. But the Kinnectock, it's not a long river. You can do that in a week. We'd prefer 10 days if you can afford the time. But the variety is there. The habitat is there. The wildlife is there. So it's a splendid river. A longer river that we've done, Keyser Alec, we did that one for about, 13 days, 14 days. And we liked that river because it had about at least four different types of habitat. And you could see all kinds of wildlife that different species of vegetation and a lot of solitude on that river. Unfortunately, when we did the Keyser Alec, the weather was more rainy than not. I think we only saw in that trip maybe a couple days of sunshine. But every other trip we've done to Alaska have been, the weather's been real accommodating. So, but the Keyser Alec was good fishing once you got below the upper falls. Above the upper falls, the water was high because of all the rain they'd had there before we got there and during that first couple days. And we fished other rivers in Alaska, but Bristol Bay is a very special place.
Yeah, you mentioned, for instance, the Good News in your book as a river, and I've heard a lot of good news about the Good News.
Sure.
I didn't float it from the headwaters on down, but I did fish the Togiak, and I believe that's one that's floatable too, right?
It is, and it's another good rainbow river. I like to choose, and my friends do too, waters that are clear. Mm-hmm. I don't care for the glaciated stuff. Mainly, when you're floating, you're out of the boat a lot. You're stopping at gravel bars, fishing below the gravel bars and sometimes above, or fishing straight across if there's runs. But when you're up there, you want to see where your feet are going when you are wading. Of course, you don't want to wade out where the reds are, the eggs, but you have to be careful where you wade. But still, it's nice to know where your feet are going. And in a glaciated river, it's tough to see. You don't know if you're going to step in a hole or what. And it just seems like the fishing, to me anyway, is always better in a clear river than a glaciated river. Mm-hmm. And so those rivers in Bristol Bay, just about all of them that I'm aware of, are pretty much clear rivers unless you get into the Pusquim, the huge river, or some of the very big rivers that after a rain can become turbid and almost glaciated looking. Mm-hmm. But if you get the smaller rivers, you get clear rivers, and it's just, to me, more of a pleasure to fish.
Yeah, I noticed that most of the rivers that you listed in your book, and there are more than what you just talked about, but a lot of them seem to be 50 to 66 miles in length. And are most of the, are you floating those full lengths in most cases?
Well, we try to float as far as we can. What we'd like to do to get a synopsis, we We prefer to find a good place on the river where you can camp that's got a good hole or a good salmon run or whatever. It might be a lot of rainbows there because of the salmon. But we like to try to do a two-night campsite in a spot like that, mainly because it takes a lot of time to break down your camp. And if you move every day, you're spending a lot of time, a lot of hours, breaking down the camp, cleaning up the campsite, packing your raft, and getting on your way. And we just found it's more relaxing if you can do more days on a trip, say 12 or 14 days, and try to have every campsite for same one for two nights and then move on. If you try to do a trip in 5 or 6 days, you're really rushing it, even if it's a 50-mile trip, and you're going to pass a lot of good fishing water.
Yeah.
But if you have that two-day system like we do, you can afford to be a little more leisure on your trip down the river and enjoy the scenery, enjoy the fishing, and the relaxation just more. It's not a big rush.
Yeah, I think that's a great tip. Yeah, I think that's a great tip you've just given out, because I've done a lot of floating, and I've done the Grand Canyon 21 days, and we only had 2 layover days in 21 days. And, of course, we're not trying to fish on that one, and that makes a big difference. You know, if you're just running rivers for the scenery and the water, that's one thing. But when you're trying to get fishing in, it's important to have that time available, like you say. And I know, too, from experience on the Togiak, there's these tributaries that can be great, too.
Exactly.
You know, for char or dollies or that kind of thing. So you want to be able to take advantage of some of those as well, I would expect.
Well, remember, it's a privilege to be anywhere on those rivers. Some countries you're not allowed to do that. And you don't know if you do say the Keys or Alec, you don't know if you'll ever get back. So why rush through it?
Right.
Why not spend the time and enjoy it and just relax instead of being in a big hurry?
Right. So you're suggesting, 12 to 14 days as a little
bit? If you can afford the time and, of course, the money, because your bigger expense on the extra time is going to be your raft rental. They're going to run about $100 a day. But if you split that up with your party, it's not all that expensive.
Right.
It's certainly less expensive than if you did a return trip. I guess what I'm saying, if you did a river for 7 days, then you got home and regretted that, well, I missed this and I missed that because we went through too fast. If you'd have had that extra time, you know, to do the extra 7 days, then you would not have to go back.
Right.
Or you just enjoy it more.
Well, and plus, whenever you're traveling, you know, halfway around the world to go fishing or on any kind of vacation, you have the weather to deal with, like you mentioned earlier. And so the longer the trip, the more chance you have of having some decent weather during those days, too. So
that's true. If you get a day, well, we were stuck at Kizaralik Lake for, I think, a day and a half after they dropped us off. The Grum and Goose out of Dillingham, they dropped us off, but we were stuck in our tents for a day and a half. But fortunately, we had enough days to make up for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when you're in the lake and high wind and a lot of rain blowing sideways, it's not a whole lot you can do.
Yeah. Now, what's the skill level necessary for boatmen, to row these rivers?
Well, that, of course, depends on the river itself, because they're going to be rapids rated from 1 to 5. 6, I guess, would be a waterfall like over the left-hand side of the upper falls on the Keys Relic. I'd definitely rate that a 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never try to go over that, although I heard guys that did and demolish their cataract. But on a 1 would be a good starter for somebody who doesn't have any boat skills or has never done rafting. Although I would surely suggest that somebody, at least somebody in the party, has some knowledge of how to row a drift boat or a raft or cataract. And I mean with oars, not 3 or 4 people in a boat with canoe paddles. That just doesn't work for a trip like this. But you can gain that experience on any river anywhere in the United States. But when you're in Alaska, remember, you're a long way from anywhere, and so you have to avoid trouble no matter what you're doing. If you're not sure the water you're going to go through, get out, tie off in the bank, get out, and walk ahead and search and look for your water, look for the route you're going to take, because you sure don't want to dump a raft up in any of those cold waters. You're a long way from the Coast Guard or any kind of help. So just common sense.
Now, are there river maps available for these rivers like we have down here in the lower 48, the Mark Rapids?
Not the detailed map that you'll see of certain rivers like the Grand Canyon or the Green River.
Right.
Generally, you just have to purchase your U.S. Geological Survey maps. And remember, the amount of runoff they get up there each year, the river channels are going to change on a year-to-year basis. Just gravel's going to move, trees are going to be knocked down, log jams are going to be created. So that's why you have to really watch the oarsmen and even the people in the boat have to watch. And if you're not sure what's coming up, beach the boat or tie it off on a bank and walk ahead. But when you walk ahead, make sure you take your firearm, definitely your bear spray, but if you have your firearm, take it because you do not know when you're going to run into a grizzly.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. Always a concern. Always a concern.
Sure.
You mentioned doing two nights in a campsite. Do you have an approximation of how many miles you like to make in a day?
Well, there again, that depends. Some rivers have better campsite situations than others. The Keyser Alley, I can remember, we had to really search, and so sometimes we went 15, 18 miles in a day. And the rivers like the Aniak, you could find a good campsite every 2-3 miles. Kinectoc had plenty of good campsites. It just totally depends on the river and the type of water you want to fish and, of course, how good the fishing is. If you go in July and August, remember that the sun stays up a long, long time, so you can float, say, till 10 o'clock at night if you wish, and we've done that a few times looking for what we call the perfect campsite.
Right.
So
it's a little bit more difficult than running rivers down here in the lower 48 because you don't have all that data of campsites and rapids and so forth.
Right, there are no established campsites like if you went, we did a canoe trip up in Boundary Waters, and there, even though they're lakes, you're required to camp in established campsites, and I believe you are in the Grand Canyon, although I've never floated the Grand Canyon, but that is not the case in Alaska. But you want an ideal campsite where good fishing, firewood, where the bears can see you from a distance so they don't surprise. There's no surprise to them when you're camping and they come walking around a pile of brush or bushes or willows or alders or whatever. So there's several things that go into a good campsite, but definitely you want a good place to fish and then firewood and visibility.
Well, let's take a quick break here, Don, and when we come back, we'll talk more about get into some equipment and so forth that are necessary. So hang with me just for a few seconds here, and I'll be right back. Mystic Fly Rod's new Switch series is turning heads and taking it easy on your wallet, a refreshing trend in today's premium fly rod market. To learn why this Switch was selected as America's number one switch rod in Fly Fish America's 2012 Gear Guide, visit MysticOutdoors.com. That's MysticOutdoors.com. Or cruise over to your local fly shop to unleash its power. We dare you to compare the Switch or any Mystic fly rod to your current favorite. Once you do, we think you'll agree that Mystic is the new brand of choice in premium fly rods. Make the switch to Mystic at www.mysticoutdoors.com. That's www.mysticoutdoors.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Don Crane about Floating Alaska, self-guided fishing expeditions. If you'd like to ask Don a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Don, I always ask my guests at this point in the show what's going on in their fly fishing world. So what have you been up to?
Well, I've been to the Safari Club International Convention there in Las Vegas last month, and that's been my primary timekeeper this winter, getting ready for that, and then follow up with the clients that come to our booth. Fishing here in Cody, February is very windy. Fortunately, I get to do some good fishing tomorrow. I have the Shoshone River about a mile from my house, so A couple friends and I are going out tomorrow, and hopefully we'll have a good day with some blueing olives and probably some midges for rainbows and browns and cutthroats. But February was just kind of a lousy month. The wind was just terrible up here. Cold wind and too much of it. So in April, sometime in April, my family and I were going to South Carolina, and I'm going to do some fishing down there for popping bugs on hopefully bass and crappie, and then maybe we'll get a chance to go after some deep water catfish. So looking forward to that very much.
Sounds good.
So other than that, just work, and I need more play. I need to do more play, that's for sure.
We all do. Mm. Well, good. Well, why don't you share with us the website for the Safari?
Our website is www.safari1.com, and that one is a numeral one, not the name. Okay, www.safari1.com.
Safari1.com. Terrific.
Yes, we're the oldest booking agency in the world. We send hunters and fishermen all over the world, but mainly hunters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Okay, let's jump back in here and talk more about self-guided trips in Alaska. There was a question from Chris in Trenton, New Jersey. He asked, are there places that can be self-guided to catch dollies, bows, and Arctic char on the same trip? I guess by that he's assuming that your primary fish are after are salmon.
Yes, the two rivers there in the Bristol Bay I mentioned that we fished, well, especially the Kinnectock. That was special. And Arctic char, we met one fellow there. He was using a five-weight fly rod. And he was going every year for the dollies, the big dollies, and Arctic char. And he seemed to care less about the salmon. He just wanted the big dollies and char. Mm-hmm. So I would say the Kinnectock would be a good starter.
Yeah, that's, as I mentioned earlier, when we were on the Togiak, they took us up for a day on, I think it was called Cache Creek. It was a tributary. And up that creek, we caught dollies. We caught char, and I caught a grayling all in that one little tributary, you know, in that one afternoon. So, and that was one of the most fun days we had, I think, even over the salmon.
And grayling is fun. A lot of people pass up grayling, but I enjoy catching grayling. A gorgeous fish.
Yeah, and the dollies were big. I mean, we were catching, I remember I had just caught a 26-inch dolly, and I was yelling at my son saying, hey, I just caught a 26-inch dolly. And he goes, really? I got a big one, too. And he says, let me see here. He says, it's 27 inches.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Your offspring should always. My daughter, when we went to South Island, New Zealand, she caught the biggest trout. When we tarpon fishing in Costa Rica, she caught the biggest. Pike fishing in Saskatchewan, of course, she caught the biggest. But that keeps her interest up. So that's great.
Yeah.
That's the way it should be.
Oh, I mean, it just put smiles on our parents' faces, you know, as we watched that. Same thing happened to me tarpon fishing, too. My son did really well, and I didn't do so well. So there's a lot of opportunity on one trip if you take it, I think. Now, Chris in Farmington, Utah also asked, is there a good opportunity to fish rivers without floating? Can you drive or backpack into good locations? And I think where we're
there are, although I've never done it this way. If you get to Alaska, I guess you pronounce it Gazetteer, and on about page 10 or whatever, at least on mine, about page 10 is a whole list of rivers and lakes freshwater fishing in Alaska. And it's a pretty cool set of pages because it tells you which river, if it's going to run clear or murky, and then what fish species, and then how you access that river, whether it's by vehicle or by boat or float plane. So that would be my suggestion on the first place to look. And then once you decide on a selection of rivers, get a hold of the fish biologist in that region and ask for the current update. And those phone numbers and such, they're all listed in my book, but mm-hmm. for the biologists. But that would be the best source to start with, is that Gazetteer. I think they sell for about $20. I'm sorry.
They list rivers over in the Bristol Bay area as well, or is that
they don't list all of the rivers in the Bristol Bay, but Bristol Bay is not many roads, so most of the Bristol Bay rivers,
right,
you're going to be air charter, right, float plane into them and then float. Some of the other rivers in that book, I think, are down in southwest Alaska and even maybe down on, you know, the Kenai and in that country. I know my brother, he likes to fish the upper Kenai. He goes about every 2 years fishing for the rainbow on a fly rod. The rainbow are below the salmon spawn. And he and two or three other guys, in a couple of days, they caught and released something like 127 rainbows. And they were all good size, all the way up to 12 pounds. So that's one you can definitely drive to. And I believe they were staying at a lodge, or it's more of a, I wouldn't call it a hostel, it's a lodge where you did your own cooking and stuff. And then they rented a boat and motor and boated up or down the river and got out and fished the gravel bars. But they like that, although it's more combat fishing than what I like.
Right.
I call it combat fishing, where you just see more people.
That's what it is on the Kenai now. But in Bristol Bay area, if one wants to know about a river, and we actually had a question in on the internet here that about grayling, and you wanted to know what species were available in that river on the trip, what would be the best way to find that out?
If it's not listed in that gazetteer, then I would phone the fish biologist for Alaska Game and Fish for that region.
For that region, okay.
Yes, and make sure you have all your questions listed out. You don't want to sit there and call him and then call him again the next day because you forgot to ask him something and then call him a week later. So think about what you want to ask him and then write it all down and try to cover everything in one conversation.
So for Bristol Bay,
I think
they'd
appreciate that a little more.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
For Bristol Bay, that would be Dillingham, I guess.
That should be Dillingham, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's talk about the rafts themselves. What do you think, a reasonable number of rafts is to go on a trip, considering campgrounds,
of course,
and people, and so forth?
That depends on the number of people. We like to have three to either a 16-foot cat raft or three to a 14-foot self-bailing raft. And we prefer the cat rafts because they seem to handle better, and they're easier to keep clean. Remember, on a regular raft, it's kind of like a catch basin for if you're eating jerky or candy or even fish blood. And at the end of the day, if you forget to clean that raft or even your cat raft, if you drip some blood on the cat when you're handling the salmon, may attract bears at night, and that's the last thing you want. But cat rafts definitely are easier to clean than a raft or a self-bailer raft. And if you get a regular raft, try to make sure it's a self-bailer. But by all means, make sure your rafts or whatever you have are clean at the end of the night when you go to bed.
So just take a bucket and go down.
Cat rafts are just marvelous pieces of equipment. They break down real well for when you're in the air charter or the float plane, and they go together pretty quick, but they handle. And it's easy, to me, it's easier to learn on a cat raft than it is a regular raft. It just seems they handle much better.
A little bit more responsive.
So I would say three, two, you don't want to overpack a raft, overweight it, or it's going to roll like a barge.
And then how many people do you think is reasonable for a trip like this?
Yeah, six to me is an ideal number. Two rafts with three.
Yeah.
Two boats, yeah. Two boats or two rafts, three to a boat. That just seems to be ideal.
Okay.
It works good if you're taking, say, a Grumman Goose. You know, all the float planes, they go by what they can carry on weight, and it just seems to work well with them, or a Beaver, the Havilland Beaver. It's three to a boat just seems to be fine. I know of groups of 12 that have gone, but that, to me, that's a lot of people, and there's always going to be one or two of those people that are not going to hold up their end, it seems like.
It's probably good to always go with at least two boats, or two, I keep saying boat, but I refer to
I know guys have gone with I know of guys that have gone, fathers and sons, that have gone with one boat. If you do that, you better make sure you have a good satellite phone. In case, what if you demolished that boat and didn't have a satellite phone?
Right.
You're going to have to wait till somebody else or a float plane comes over searching for you. If you have a second boat and somebody gets in trouble, you know, injured by a bear or whatever, at least a second boat can go for help if you don't have access to a satellite.
Right.
Anymore, I'd take a satellite phone. They weren't available, really, when we first started floating. They were expensive, but now they're not so bad, and I definitely recommend a satellite phone.
Right, right.
And you
now,
can rent those generally.
We had Dustin Olson in Utah asked, is it practical to take children on a float light trip like this?
That's a tough one. I've never been around children on an Alaska float trip. I would assume it depends on the age and how well the children behave. You're around water, so that's one thing that always concerns a parent. Number two would be bears. You're just not going to allow the children to go running off and play like they would in parts of the lower 48. So that's a decision a parent would have to make. And I would definitely be leery of taking anybody under, say, 10 years old.
Okay.
But it's tough for me to answer that one because I've never done it.
And like you say, it depends on the children, too.
It does.
They listen.
It does.
And like you say, they can't go off playing in the woods by themselves. So, how do you rig your rafts? You just mentioned that you took three people on a cataract raft, and you're able to get all your gear and everything as well as have room to fish off those boats with no problem.
Well, let's go to, say, a 16-foot cataract. For example, we'll have a big ice chest, even though there's no ice in it because all our food is dry. But still, the roar is going to sit on the ice chest, and then all the gear is going to be behind the roar, and that's going to be held down, and it'll have kind of an apron that all the gear sits on, and then you pack the gear so it balances. There'll be a good raft company or the air charter company, if that's who you're running your raft from, they should provide a big net, a cargo net that goes over all of your gear, but you still use boat straps. And we always take our own extra boat straps. You never can have too many boat straps, but all our gear, even though it's covered by a net, we try to use a boat strap, tie down each dry bag, every main item that's under that net, and then use the net that goes over all of that gear. And then on top of the net, we'll have our little bow saw in case you run into what we call a sweeper, which is a tree branch or limb out over the water. That can get you in trouble, so you want your bow saw handy. So we always have a bow saw on top of each net for the two boats, held down by a rubber snubber, so it's accessible real quick in case you caught up or need to cut a branch or some other piece of log or branch, dry branch or whatever that can get you in trouble. But you want that bow saw handy.
Good.
And then the two fishermen will be up front on a seat going across the front end, the bow of a cataract raft.
Oh,
the same thing for a regular raft. If you can,
so you don't fish out of the back.
You can. We have some people that like to sit on the top of that pile. And especially if they're throwing lures. We put the fly fishermen up front and anybody throwing lures in back because they can cover further distances. Mm-hmm. And swinging that lure, they're back out of the way. They have to be careful of the ears on the oarsman or his head. But throwing a big pixie lure, but they can cover a lot of water and they generally do real well.
You're fishing two fly fishers out of the front end of the boat?
We can. Yeah, you can. You're not making a long cast. But remember, you're just not sitting in a raft or a cataract fishing from there all day. You're stopping at every good-looking run and every good-looking hole. And quite often, there might be just when you're drifting, one guy is taking photos or running a camcorder, and the other guy is, mm-hmm. or gal is fly fishing.
Right.
But not everybody on our trip is a fly fisherman. We have a couple that all they do is throw lures, which is fine. And they're very, very good at it.
Right, right. Phil in Utah asks, is there a place that will let you do some of the planning and let you rent the gear so they keep down the cost? So let's talk a minute about raft rentals and what you take from down here and what you don't take and what you rent up there. What do you think is the best solution nowadays?
Well, when my book first came out, we were able to ship a lot of our gear up there by UPS or even take it on the plane. Of course, since then, you're limited on what you can take on commercial unless you're going to pay some pretty good prices for your extra luggage. So the last trip we did on the Aniak, we rented the tents. We have our own four-season tents here, but the last trip we rented, the air charter company had all of the camp gear, the major camp gear we needed, the tents, cooking gear, and, of course, the rafts, and then they provided air service or full plane service. So we had to take, we took our food and personal gear. And that way we were able to do it without the expense of UPS or parcel post or whatever. But before we had really, when we took our own gear, it was probably the best. This gear has gone all over, you know, all over the western states. And some of it, even though I've never been there, it's gone down through the Grand Canyon where you went. But unfortunately, our good tents had to stay home. But those Alaska tents that we got are really fine tents, and we had no complaints at all. So there are some, and I list them in the book, there are some air charter companies that do also rent all of that gear. And then you can do your own planning. And one of them is Papa Bear Adventures. That is a really good one. And he'll give you a breakdown on his website. I think it's pbadventures.com, and he will give you information on his website on costs to go to different rivers, including the Good News that you and I discussed, and different costs for tents, stoves, air charter, and that's a really good place to start. Friends of mine use Papa Bear Adventures, and they really like them. They've used them twice now.
Now, they, I know from experience, and it seems like you say, from shipping and costs of shipping nowadays, it's probably almost prohibitive to get the, you know, heavy things like rafts and frames and stuff like that up there. So when we went down the Grand Canyon, we hired an outfitter, and, you know, when we got to the put-in, the rafts were there. We even had them, in that case, pack our food for us, because packing for 21 days, of course, takes some art and finesse and some science. But I found that to be just really a lot of fun, because we didn't have to deal with those things. And it worked out really great, because they did it every day. You know, I mean, you weren't missing a thing. You basically brought your personal items and we brought our own kitchen set, but they even had those to rent as well. So is that really kind of the way it can work up there?
I think you can do it that way. We've never done it. Remember, those air charters, they can only carry so much weight, and if they can't get it on one flight, it's going to be another flight.
Right.
The more food you take, the heavier the stuff, the more flights it's going to take, and then your cost goes up. So what we do, quite a bit of dehydrated food, and then every evening we either have grayling or salmon cooked one way or other, and we don't go hungry. We don't go hungry. There's some really good dehydrated foods out there, and you can also get stuff in packages out of any good grocery store. We avoid cans and jars, because all that, you pack it in, you pack it out, and that just makes you a big, as I mentioned in the book, kind of like a big garbage scow if you have that stuff. So all the things we have are burnable, and then every morning before we break camp, we go through the fire and make sure if there's any pieces of aluminum or anything that didn't burn, then we
take that with you.
Yeah. Take it out and pack it out with us, and then clean the camp to make it look like nobody's ever been there. So we're very selective on how we package the food and what we take. For lunches, if you're not going to stop for lunch, then you eat jerky and granola and snacks all day long. You're not just stopping and chowing down a bunch of calories at one time. You may be eating a piece of jerky, and then an hour later, granola bar and a swig of water, but as long as you get your calories,
yeah,
it works well for us.
Well, that you keep bringing up points that I keep forgetting about because I'm so used to, you know, running rivers here in the Rockies and stuff. But where we don't worry about bears, you know, too much. Light bulb just went on right now for me about the dehydrated and so forth, because the more fresh food you have, the more chance of it smelling and attracting bears, I think you'd have, and that creates a whole new problem that you really don't have in a lot of these other areas. So I can see how that'd be really important.
Well, there's fellas that do their self-guided trips for hunting, like caribou hunting, and it's important for them, if they have fresh meat, is not to keep it in camp at night. They hang it, to do it properly, they hang it in a tree, maybe an eighth to a quarter mile away from the camp every night until the float plane can pick up the meat, because obviously that is about as good a bear bait as you're going to find. And if you had hamburger or anything, but remember, it'd be tough up there to keep ice. I know on the Grand Canyon trips, generally there seems like an ice chest for every night. They're all taped up, and you can't do that in Alaska. You just don't have that space in the raft.
Right.
So
dry ice.
Yes, dry ice still won't last, as far as I know, won't go 14 days or so. But the dehydrated foods are really good anymore, not a lot better than the old MREs, military rations.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Well, let's take another quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk more about doing your own expedition in Alaska. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Don Crane about Floating Alaska, self-guided fishing expeditions. If you'd like to ask Don a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. Just checking online. Oh, Treg up in Moscow wants to know, do they have dehydrated beer? This is important, Don.
If they do, I'd like to have the copyright or whatever you'd call it for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't take beer, but we do take a bottle of Jack Daniels or what. Try to do it in plastic if you can, although it's probably not the best for, might alter the taste. But every evening, you know, everybody will have a little sip of whiskey, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that hits the spot. It'd be nice to have some beer, but just there again, the weight.
Yeah, exactly. So that's something to keep in mind as a primary concern of bringing in gear, food, alcohol, is weight. Because you're going to pay for it one way or the other if you don't watch that, it sounds like. Let's see here. When you talk about other equipment that you might bring, what do you feel is absolutely a necessity that you would bring that you might not think of, you know, when you're running rivers down here in the lower 48, even on multi-day trips?
One thing I like, and I've always had a waterproof camera, but now the digitals have come out, I use a Olympus waterproof point-and-shoot. It's lightweight, and I can hang that around my neck. I used to have a Canon 35, but it's hard to find film anymore for those. So a good knife, in addition to a camera, a good knife, And I would say something like an old timer, a good size folding knife, maybe 4 inches. You can fillet with that if you have to. But if you have a good little knife sharpener, the softer steel in an old timer sharpens pretty quick. Some of the knives, I have some Gerbers that are excellent knives, but it's a little harder to get a good edge on. But if everybody had a knife, because you'd want to carry that when you're in the raft in case you flipped and somebody got a rope and you're caught up, you need to be able to get that rope cut as soon as possible. If you had a regular river knife that's in its sheath, it's like a small straight scabbard knife, that would work too. Obviously, life jackets, if you can get by, if you can take the kind that have the CO2, going through security at your airport, they may or may not let it go through because of the CO2 cartridges, but if you can do it, those are nice. They're not as bulky as the life jackets that'll come with the raft rental. Or if you take your own rafts, make sure you have top quality life jackets. A little nightlight headlight is great. You don't really need a lantern up there if you're going in July or August because, as I mentioned earlier, the sun stays up way late. Mm-hmm. You might even be in bed before the sun gets down, and it probably won't get totally dark anyway. But your personal items, your medicines, your sunblock, chapstick, good sunglasses, probably if you're my age, reading glasses to read the maps. We've taken small spotting scopes so you could glass hillsides, mountains quite a ways away, a lightweight pair of waterproof binoculars. Everybody doesn't need to take binoculars and everybody doesn't need to take a spotting scope. But if you had one of each of those for the group, that would be fine. Most people seem to take cameras. You want waterproof shoes for around camp at night. Get out of your waders or whatever. If it does rain, you don't want to be sloshing around camp. Let's see, what have I left? Of course, clothes. Well, it's all covered in the book. I don't really care for jeans, blue jeans. If you get them wet, they're going to stay wet.
Right.
Polyester, I like. It just dries fast.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I've switched to all that quick dry technical clothing over the past few years for backpacking, for hiking, for skiing, for everything because of just that of the quick to dry, and for traveling too, on vacation, same clothes, you know.
Exactly.
Rinse them out.
See our trading post here in Cody. You can get that stuff at a big discount. Brand stuff here at Sierra Trading. They have a website. It's right down a couple miles from my house, so it's quite handy.
Yeah,
you don't need to spend a lot of money, but if you have the good stuff to start with, good base layers, then you've got it covered. Obviously, good rain gear is important. Helly Hansen is good. I don't care for Gore-Tex so much. We call it Leak-Tex. When I worked for the state of Colorado, we had Gore-Tex, and it seemed like if you're in a solid rain for more than 6 or 8 hours, it wasn't doing the job after that. So, and a good packable set of nylon lightweight rain gear is just indispensable.
What about your tents and sleeping bags? Anything particular there you like or don't like? Or?
All my bags are down, but I have to be very careful so I don't get them wet. So I pack my sleeping bag in its own dry bag. And then put that dry bag in the big dry bag that has all the rest of my clothes and stuff, my personal gear. So my sleeping bag is doubly protected. But synthetic is probably better on a float trip because if you get it wet, it's going to dry much faster than down ever will. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be much fun, I suppose, sitting around every night by a fire because you can't climb in your sleeping bag because you got it wet. So
a three-piece bag adequate, do you think?
It depends, you know, the time of year you want to fish depends on the species you want. Silver salmon, mid-August to, say, mid-September, and obviously mid-September is going to get a little cool at night, but generally a three-season bag will work. Some companies I know recommend down to 0 degrees. I've got a bag like that, and I've got a bag that's rated down to about 40 degrees below zero, which, of course, I never take but, up there, but 0-degree bag is fine, but a good mat or blow up self-inflating like a thermarest pad is indispensable. And you want to sleep good. You're going to be tired, so you want to sleep good. You're going to be tired because you're going to be up maybe 18 hours with that sunlight up there.
Yeah.
You're just going to have a hard time going to bed. I mean, not that you can't sleep, but it's, you're enjoying your time so much that it's just sitting around the campfire in the evening and telling stories and reminiscing with your friends. And so it's just going to be hard to go to bed because you're having so much fun.
What about...
But when you do go to bed, you want to be able to sleep well.
What are you doing for water purification, human waste, and trash? How do you manage that?
Okay. For water, that's a very good question. For water, we always have about a gallon and a half aluminum pot, and it's always on the campfire boiling. We also take water purifier. The last trip, or last couple trips, each of us had an individual bottle that had a removable filter. So when you're out in the middle of the river floating, you take the lid off the bottle, pop the filter out, dip the bottle in the river, and put everything back together, and you're ready to go. So we've taken bigger filters, but the important thing is we always have water boiling in camp. We use that for cooking, and we use it for dishes. And then when we're doing dishes, we always add a drop of Clorox or two to the rinse water, just to make sure you don't want Giardia.
Right.
And that would be the major thing you could get. For sanitation, individual holes, and take a little shovel and toilet paper when you go out there when you're done. We'll dig your hole a foot deep if you can. Take matches with you and burn the toilet paper and then cover it up. Just don't go out in the woods and do your thing and walk away. Make sure nobody knows you're around when you're done. So.
So you don't have to...
That's a home for the native people up there, and treat it right.
So you don't have to take out human waste then like you do in many of the rivers down?
You do when you go down, like on the lower end of Kanaktok, when you're in the native land. There's, what, a 15, 20-mile stretch, and there's a cabin there. You have to stop and get a bucket, and then you use that if you camp or need to use, you can go to the bathroom there when you're on the native lands. Yes, you have to pack it out. But when you're up on the BLM, which is above that, then no, you don't have to pack it out.
So you don't actually bring a groover along or anything like
no,
that?
No, we don't take groovers, huh?
Yeah.
We never have, and we've never really needed them. But as I mentioned, our campsites, when we're done with them, you can hardly tell except for footprints in the sand that we've ever even been there.
Right, right. Well, that's the way it should be, yeah. You had talked earlier about, let me back up a little bit, too, before we move on to that area. Scott in Reno asked about, what do you feel each person should be allowed to carry as far as weight? Do you have some kind of guidelines for the people on the trip saying, hey, you can only bring X amount of pounds?
Well, that weight is going to be based on what your airplane, of course, and it will be able to carry and how many trips you want the airplane to do. If you just, say, have six people and it takes two planes, obviously you just want one trip per plane in. So you have to be very careful. And there again, and to start with, it's going to depend on the weight of the person. Because that's going to go against of each person. That's going to go against your total weight. Well, that's a tough one because not everybody weighs the same, and always.
Do you work backwards? Like you say, well, you know, we're going to get a Grumman Goose, and we've got X amount of weight.
That'll carry about 1,800 pounds.
So you got to subtract the people off, and then.
Start with the people and then your gear, but they will weigh, your charter companies will actually weigh you and your gear before they need to know what's going on that plane. So you might have everything laid out. And I would say the best thing maybe to do is lay it out in priorities, like items, one pile items that have to go, and number two, items that you can get along without, because you may be throwing out some of that pile out of number two if you're overweight.
Right.
And...
But starting planning back here in the U.S. or wherever you are in the world, if you work backwards from that 1,800 pounds, you should be able to figure that out, right?
obviously, if you have a guy that weighs, you know, 280 or 300 pounds, that's a detriment right off the start.
Yeah, you might have to eat him while you're out there.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's
cutting into my food,
one.
You know.
Yes, find out what river you want to go, what air charter you're going to use, what planes they have available, and they will tell you what those planes can carry, and then work from those numbers. But you need to start with what each person weighs. That'd be the very first start as far as what each person's going to take. And we've had people do laundry up there, you know, wash out underwear and take.
Sure.
When you do stuff like that, by the way, make sure it's biodegradable soap for any of your personal hygiene or dishes. Make sure it's biodegradable soap. By the way, that's very important.
Right. You had mentioned earlier about, well, one other thing before we move on to bears and wolves and other critters is camping. Do you try to camp on islands, or is that possible? Or, I mean, again, the
islands are nice because generally you'll have a channel on either side that's fishable, but that's not always the case. But we like gravel bars or sand. Obviously, sand is, you drag that into the tent. If you can get a fine gravel, that's the best, but you want to be out in the open on that gravel. When you want, if you have women there, you need a place where they can, set up a bathroom or where they can go use the bushes without everybody gawking at them. But as I mentioned, you need to be out in the open enough where bears can see you from a distance, you know, maybe 50 yards or whatever. And that's not always possible either, but most of the time you'll be able to find a campsite on a river like that. But
and the idea behind that is the bear, if they see you from a distance, will probably move
yes,
on.
Yes, you don't want to ever surprise. If you were camped in the bushes and the wind was wrong and a sow with cubs came around a corner and saw you, you could be in a world of hurt. So if you're at a distance, 50 yards, hopefully that sow, if she saw you at 50 yards, she's going to take the cubs and go back the other way. But you always want to be prepared for that.
Let's talk about that here in just a minute after I take a break, and we'll talk about bears and wolves and other critters that you might run into. So we'll be right back. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. Okay, Don, let's talk a little bit about bears and so forth. We got a couple questions. One on the internet from Jim Kilburn. He wants to know what kind of firearms you recommend. And Steve Perry in Monument, Colorado says, I understand that shooting a bear is a last resort, but I've heard Beneke? 12-gauge slugs are recommended over Foster against large Alaskan bears. Do you concur? Do you have another weapon or round recommendation?
I can't comment on those particular slugs that he suggests. I assume that they're good. The only thing we've ever taken are the 2 3/4 inch, either Remington or Winchesters, and the heaviest powder we can get. Unfortunately, we've never had to use a shotgun on a bear. My shotgun is a short 20-inch barreled Remington 870 with a sling, and then I clean it every evening. I wipe it down with the pre-oiled Hoppy's rag to make sure it functions. But friends of mine have taken 44 mags and shoulder holsters. If you do that, another friend of mine did a trip last year, I think, they might have done, they did the Keyser Alec. It was his first trip on the Keyser Alec, and he took, I think, a 6 or 6.5-inch barrel Smith & Wesson 44 mag, he found it out. It was very, very heavy. So if you're going to take a revolver like that, I would recommend the shortest barrel you can handle. If you had to shoot at a bear, it's not going to be at 50 yards. It might be 10 feet, 12 feet. So, but if you're fishing all day, you don't want to be packing five pounds or whatever long-barreled, loaded 44 mag would weigh, or 454 casual. They're going to be heavy. So a shorter barrel, I would think, if I was going to buy one, it'd be stainless steel, and it'd be a shorter barrel.
What about Craig Owens from Moscow, Idaho, wrote in on the internet. He wanted to know about other types of bear protection. Do you take bear spray as well? Or?
Oh, yes, but you can't take that on commercial airplanes anymore, so you'll either need to buy that, say, in Dillingham, or check ahead and see if you can get that from your air charter company. Most of those people
can't put that in luggage underneath the plane?
You can't put bear spray in luggage.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good to know. So have you had any encounters with bears in all the trips you've done up there?
I can remember, I forget what river, we woke up in the morning, there was a big bear that walked within 3 feet of the tent. It just kept on going. But we keep our campsite clean. We, of course, do dishes every night, burn any scraps of food.
No food.
If there's any parts of fish, entrails or whatever, they go out in the middle of the river. But we make sure our campsite is clean every night. And what we do, we have our food boxes, and we always put some pots and pans on top of the lid at night, act as an alarm in case a bear did come along. We'd hear that clanking, and we keep our weapons in the tent and with our lights ready to go. But we've never had that problem either. But mainly the important thing is keep your raft clean and keep your camp clean, and you shouldn't have any problems.
Any problems with, like, wolves?
No, we've seen tracks and we've seen wolves, but never had any problem. They seem to be more leery of you than
yeah. What about Bob in Burnville, Pennsylvania wants to know about that other more important adversary out there?
Mosquitoes. We always try to go. We like silver salmon, and we try to go around the latter part of August, and hopefully you'll have a freeze by then. We've never had serious mosquito problem, although my brother, he always wore his mosquito net. I never did take a net. I guess I just got used to it. But you need to, if you do take your mosquito dope, and you should, whether a good rub on, if it has DEETS, make sure you're not allergic to it. Try it out at home. You have to be careful with DEETS. It can eat fly lines and suplex waders. So you got to be very careful with what you do. I found that the no-see-ums, the gnats, more annoying to me than mosquitoes. If you get bites from no-see-ums, you start scratching them, and they'll stay around for a month on your arm or your neck or wherever.
Yeah, yeah.
Mosquito bites, you know, 2-3 days, they're gone. But I've never experienced any major mosquito problems because, as I mentioned, we try to go after a freeze.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to go in June, you know, when the king salmon are running, then you better be prepared for mosquitoes.
Okay. Chris in Farmington, Utah, and Douglas McLean up in Calgary, Alberta, want to know about, you know, what you recommend to take as far as equipment in the way of rods, weight rods, sizes, lines, that kind of thing.
Well, I'm strictly a fly fisherman, and believe it or not, I use my 5-weight Sage on, I've caught chum salmon up to, 12, 14 pounds, silver salmon. It's a ball. But if you hook into a king salmon, a late season king salmon on that, you better have your track shoes because you're going to be heading out to the ocean. They're going to run downstream, and a 5-weight, you'd be doggone lucky to hold it. Even I've taken 9-weights for king salmon, and sometimes you get a big 50-pound king, and 9-weights a little light. But if you're going later in, if you're going in August for the silvers and dollies and chars and rainbows, 5, 6, or 7 would be fine. Mm-hmm. If you're going earlier when the kings are running, then 10 or 11 would be great, and then a smaller rod for the dollies and rainbows. you know, 6 and 11 or something. Two rods is nice if you break one, or if you have a rod. When I take my 5-weight, I always make sure I have two tips with it.
Okay.
And then my reels are all large arbor lamps. I use lamps and light speeds. And for all my reels that I take, I have floating lines, and then I use teeny sink tip lines. And I've got along real well with those. I can't complain about any of my fly fishing gear. My techniques I can complain about sometimes, because sometimes you wish you could cast or do things better than you do at that time. And
right.
But I can't complain about my gear.
Now,
flies,
lines, do you need any sink tip or sinking lines?
Well, the teenies are like, I use a T300 on my 9-weight and T200 on the 7-weight, and those are sink. I think what the lower 20 or the head, the 20 or 25 feet, I think is I forgot the exact measurement, but it's color-coded, and those are sinking the tips. Mm-hmm. And that's all you need. Your rivers you're fishing, you're not going to be fishing 20 feet deep. You know, those salmon, most of the stuff you're going to be catching, probably no more than 8, maybe sometimes 10 feet of water, but very seldom you're going to find holes that are 20 feet deep. You'll see a few, but those teenies will get them down, and there's other good quality brands too, but that's just the ones I've had good success with.
Okay, then, moving on to flies. George Fant in Alabama. I had a couple of questions. Chad in Fort Collins, Randy in Logan, Jackson, Michigan, are all asking about what kind of flies to bring, and I suppose that's seasonal as well, and depending on what you're targeting, right?
Well, you can really overload on what you could take 50 fly boxes all packed to the gills, and you're going to find you're only going to use a few patterns. One of the best patterns we found for silvers is a streamer called a popsicle, marabou, and it's just a great multicolored fly, mostly kind of a purplish blue, some orange on it. And of course, egg sucking leeches, and some rivers, well, like the Kanaktok, egg sucking leeches worked really well there, but other rivers not so good. But the popsicle seemed to work just about everywhere. But you can use the egg patterns and babine specials, and there's all kinds, but just a few of each. I would go with the egg sucking leeches and the popsicle egg patterns. A good egg pattern I found at, I think it might have been out of Dan Bailey's in Montana. It was it's a sparkle egg, and you just super glue it on your egg hook, and that's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to tie it, and it's a real effective, simple fly. You can get them in different sizes, but you'll catch grayling on that. You'll catch trout on it, occasionally salmon. But I prefer to throw the streamers like the popsicle from the silvers. Then you'll catch northern pike on that on certain rivers, like the lower end of the Keyser Alley. I have pike.
Hmm.
And then for dry flies, you can take some humpies for the grayling, and of course, you can always catch grayling on egg patterns.
But
you just don't need a big selection. You just don't need a big selection of flies. You need plenty of them, of good ones, but not a big, wide selection of varieties.
It seems to me I remember us using, was it an AP Black we used for nymphs, for dollies and grayling, and even for chum salmon. We're hitting on some nymphs.
Yeah, we've caught those on weighted beadhead halfbacks, or you can just weight down, just tie up or buy, purchase a weighted beadhead, tungsten bead would be better, and just a black nymph.
Right.
And,
that's what that AP black was.
They work quite well.
Yeah, so, and I know I don't have it handy here, but I know I had a book when I went up there that had a lot of the favorite Alaskan patterns in it. I know there's one out there. I can't think of the title right off the top of my head, but, yeah, I remember taking a lot more than I ever used up there when I went, so I hear you on that. You just don't need a whole lot up there. So the popsicle is your favorite, huh?
I think so, yes. And one of my friends on one of the trips got me onto those. And so my next trip with him, boy, I made sure I had like three dozen. And when you do cast a popsicle, when you lose them, it's generally when you're casting, when you're floating, because you might be in a ripple or something. If you cast too far and hang up on the shore, the way that raft, you're just gonna have to break it off. So that's where you're probably gonna lose it.
Yeah.
Because normally you don't lose them on fish, because you're fishing a pretty good sized tippet. Maybe it was otter or one, depending on what you're fishing for. But generally an otter one, or possibly a two. But generally when you lose flies is when you're actually casting from the moving raft. And that's, you know, when you black to daisy or overconfident or whatever, or try to get too finesse and cast into a pocket. One fly, though, I do recommend, if you want to have some really good times, is use some mouse patterns for the rainbow. Nothing prettier than a leopard rainbow if you catch one 5 or 6 pounds with that gorgeous crimson stripe. But you're casting... The best fun I think I had was casting those mouse patterns right behind sweepers, you know, the tree limbs and stuff. And you would think a rainbow would come up and just smash it and make it look like somebody flushing the toilet. But the ones I've caught, you can hardly see the fly disappear. They just sip it. But boy, when you set the hook, it's an explosion. And we've used them at night on Colorado rivers. We've used for rainbow trout. And I'm sure they'd work up there in Alaska at night for rainbows, too, although we're usually in bed when that happens. But you want to take a dozen or two of those mouse patterns. That is a thrill.
Yeah. Now, Randy Logan here in Jackson, Michigan, also asked, he said, you know, he's going the end of August, first part of September. But one thing that's common throughout the season is the eggs, right? Because, I mean, they start with the kings, and, I mean, there's all...
Yeah, you're going to have eggs as long as there's a... As long as there's a salmon run, there's going to be eggs, and then the rainbows and the grayling and everything else are going to be just downstream from the reds or the spawning areas, and they're picking up those eggs. So,
much luck.
Yeah, you should always have some. You can always fall by. A lot of guys think it's below themselves to fish with eggs, but you know what works. And as long as you're not taking fish home on these trips, you know, it's catch and release. For us, anyway, and
the only
fish we ever keep is what we're having for supper that night.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, I prefer grayling over the salmon. They're not quite as rich. Grayling, to me, is almost like a walleye, you know, a real mild white, and you can cook it various ways, but it still comes out great. Salmon is really good, but it's rich, and it seems after having salmon 3 or 4 nights in a row, you're looking for the grayling, something a little more mild. But that's my particular taste. I sure like to eat grayling.
Right.
Well, the Aniak River, we...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the Aniak River, we did... had big grayling in them up to, 18 inches. And one of those made a pretty fine meal.
Yeah. Dustin, here's of course, the question everybody's been waiting for all night. Dustin in Olson, Utah, wants to know, you know, what's the cost for a trip... do-it-yourself trip, what things are involved that you need to consider?
Okay. Well, in my book, I use the Good News River as an example, about a 10 or 11-day trip. And back when I wrote the book in 2004, it came out to about not including your airfare up to not including your airfare to Alaska. It came to about... $1,800 per person for about a 10 or 11 day float on the Good News, and that included your air charter and raft rental and just about it, license and food and everything. That same trip now, about 8 years after that book came out, it's going to run you pretty close to $3,000. And mainly the cost of the air charter because of fuel has gone up and your commercial flights have gone up. Boat rentals back then were about $70 a day, and now they're $100 a day. You split that three ways with three people to a boat, $33 or whatever per person per day. So that's not too bad. But I know, like at Aniak, they have to barge all their airplane fuel and auto fuel. So that is very expensive. And when we were there, it was about $8 a gallon, and I don't know what it's running now with the oil prices. I assume quite a bit more than that. So that's why air charters are so expensive. And then Most of those pilots and those charter companies, they don't get to fly year-round. They're float planes, so they have to make their money in a short period of time. Well, and now, in some places, at some of those towns, you know, with air charters, they don't have a lot of competition. And air charters, if you're only a game in town, you got to pay, you know, what that fellow wants, if that's where you want to fly out of.
So restate that again, if because there's certain shared costs there and so forth, but you have to go with, what, a minimum of three people to make any sense?
I would say three people, yes. If one person got hurt and...
Well, I mean, from
so
a cost.
One person with him, if you had to send somebody out for help, one could go and...
Yeah. I mean, from a cost standpoint, though.
Oh, standpoint. Well, yeah, three works out. Just it's good for the raft size, and it's cheaper for everybody. If you only had three guys going, that would be fine. If you had six going, that's fine.
So the example that you have in the book...
be cheaper than two or four.
Yeah.
But you don't want to put five people to one raft just to...
Right
down cost.
But I'm just trying to, so that people can figure out what it's going to cost here. When you said before 1800, and maybe I wasn't following you closely enough, but.
Actually, yeah, looking back in my book here, it came out in 2004 for the Good News for, let's see, 11 days trip. It came out to $1,874 a person, but that included a $50, a $50 license for King Salmon stamp, so. If you're going in August, you don't need the King Salmon stamp, so that would have made it about 18 and a quarter. But nowadays, 8 years later, that's going to come to closer to 3,000, and mostly due to the air charter. The air charter is just about doubled from 2004. And then
this little list was included a flight from Anchorage to Dillingham.
Right.
So basically, what would be in addition to this would be your food that you're bringing with you, and
I included that in this list too.
Oh, okay.
Everything's in there except in that list except your flight to Anchorage.
Anchorage, okay. Yeah.
Yes.
And for folks that have not done this kind of thing before, generally you fly into Anchorage and then you fly on another jet to Dillingham, and then out of Dillingham you take a float plane or of some sort or another that. Takes you to your final destination, usually lands right in the river or lake, and then dumps you off. So that's what you're talking about as far as charter flights go, right?
Mm-hmm. But still, you know, when you look at, say, $3,000 for 11 days, if you were going to do 11 days at a lodge in Alaska, it would probably run you
5 or 6.
Well, 1 week, anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000. 2 weeks, double that. So, and a lot of these rivers you can float don't have lodges on them, so you're kind of secluded in places and a whole lot of people haven't seen.
Right.
So it's just if you want to be catered to, or if you want to be self-sufficient and be proud of that you can do something that not a whole lot of people in the world have done. I mean, there's thousands of people out there that thousands have done self-guided trips, but that's minuscule number compared to the number that could do it.
Right. Well, we're running out of time here. Is there any last words you'd like to say to the folks as far as recommendations or do's or don'ts?
Yes, I think anybody interested in Alaska should get involved and take a look at the what's happening there in Bristol Bay with the Pebble Mine. That would be a mining operation that would just almost utterly destroy one of the finest sockeye fisheries in the world. Remember, that's home to the natives people that have been there for thousands of years. But this would be for people to get rich on copper and as I understand, copper and gold. And it would be, what I've seen is a magnificent Bristol Bay area. It's got to be protected. And to my way of thinking, any politician that's supporting that pebble mine operation, should probably be voted out of office. That's how important I believe that Bristol Bay is.
Yeah, you just have to go up there to see what, you know, what that land is like. And
once you see it, I think you'll agree with me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, good. Well, stick with us, folks. In fact, we do have a little public service announcement for that as well here coming up. But We're going to wrap things up here. And, Don, stick around here. We're going to give away your book, Floating Alaska, courtesy of Amato Publications, and also that year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So stick with us here for just a few more minutes, and we'll do those contests and giveaways and wrap things up. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. Pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org. That's SaveBristolBay.org. And there you'll learn more about how you can get involved and make a difference in this battle. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away our prizes here. And we are going to give away first a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you didn't register for this yet, it's a little late now, but next time be sure you register for our show, because we choose the people from our registration database just randomly, let the computer select them. And so tonight, and if you do win this, we'll send you an email and so that we can get the information we need to get you your prize or your membership or whatever. The Federation of Fly Fishers, one-year membership to that. And if you don't know about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and there you'll be able to find out more about what the Federation does and the contributions they're making to our great sport. Our winner there is Eric Seal in Pennsylvania. So, Eric, congratulations on that one-year membership. And if you already have a membership, we'll get you an extension for that. So congrats on that. I know you'll enjoy it. And our winner here for Fly Fusion Magazine, and if you want to know more about Fly Fusion, if you don't win a subscription tonight, it's go to www.flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Great publication out of Calgary, Canada, and I know you'll enjoy it if you subscribe. Let me see who we've got for winner there. We got James Midget, it looks like, James Midget. And James is in Tennessee. So, James, congratulations on that. And I know you'll enjoy your subscription. So now let's give away Don's book here. And to do this, what you do have to do is be the first person to answer correctly the question that I'm going to ask here. And I'm going to make this a little two-part question to make it a little bit more difficult. And let's see here. Use that text box on our homepage to put in your answers, and be sure you put your name and location in there to qualify for that as well. A couple of things that came out of this. One thing that Don mentioned that he thought was real important to keep on top of your pile of gear when you're running the river for emergency purpose was what? He talked about this and said you may need it quickly. And what would be that piece of equipment? I thought that was a great tip. And, boy, Treg, you're just right on top of things, aren't you? So we got Treg Wings here from Moscow, Idaho. And, Don, he says a bow saw. Has he got it?
He got it. That's correct.
He got it. Okay. And I thought that was a great tip. So, Treg.
Yeah, there I am real quick, though, is a – if you only have the shotgun, make sure that's quite handy, too.
Yeah, there you go.
Definitely. You don't want that buried.
Yeah, that needs to be ready, willing and able, right, so to speak. So, Treg, send me your contact information again, and we'll get Frank Amato Publications to send you out Don's book, Floating Alaska. And to learn more about other Frank Amato publications, go to AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com, and you can see all they have available. They have a wonderful selection of books out there. So that's about it. Thanks, Don, so much for being on the show tonight, and really appreciate you taking time out to be with us and share your knowledge.
Thanks, Roger. I truly enjoyed it, and thank you for the privilege.
You're welcome. Our next broadcast will be on March 21st and 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll be interviewing April Volke, and our topic for the show will be Steelhead of the Dean River. April, a professional guide and fly fishing instructor, has been pursuing the elusive steelhead most of her life. The Dean River in British Columbia is world-renowned for having some of the strongest fish in the world. So listen in to hear how April fishes this great river for one of the most challenging fish, the steelhead. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fishing Magazine, Outcast Boats, Mystic Rods, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.